This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday the 4th of June on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. There's been a lot going on in London over the past few days, and I'm not just talking about the Queen's Diamond Jubilee celebrations. It's also been a big week in the capital in the world of design, and hence today's show has a bit of a blighty theme to it. Coming up, we sit down with Thomas Heatherwick at the opening of his new exhibition at the V&A.
You can initiate projects, and I believe in trying to initiate them if no one's asking a certain kind of thing to happen. You're only as good as your commissioner.
We see the best of what's on offer at the mid-century furniture show at Lord's Cricket Ground.
More people now will consider buying something that's not just second-hand, but that's a mid-century piece for the fact they're buying it because they can tell that it's got a history and they know it's good quality, you know.
And we tear through the leafy streets of Clerkenwell as it opens its doors for the third Clerkenwell Design Week.
The area has a history of craftsmanship. It's grown from watchmakers and map makers and slowly led through to the current adoptees of the area. Mm-hmm.
All that, plus we head over to Auckland to find out about fashion designer Doris DuPont's favourite things. And we talk to Thomas Johansson at Electrolux in Stockholm. That's all to come on this week's Section D here on Monocle 24. Thomas Heatherwick is arguably the greatest British designer working today. His studio has an extraordinary range and breadth of output, each project more impressive than the last, from furniture and buildings to the British Pavilion at the Shanghai Expo, and even the new Routemaster bus on the streets of London. It's appropriate then that the V&A chose the title of his retrospective, which opened last week, as Designing the Extraordinary. Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, headed over to the V&A for the exhibition's opening to find out more from the man himself.
This is 18 years of work, so in some cases you're chasing something, and one project just happened because of actually an interview. It's the only time it's ever happened where someone said, "What's your ideal project?" I said, "A power station." And because of that, we were approached to do a power station. The frustrating thing as a designer is that I believe that the most creative moment seems to be the designers, and the designers and architects, we always get the coverage, but is before us, and it's the strategic decision that a commissioner makes and their vision of what something would be, and they're picking you because you're their hands to do it. And there are fashions for what commissioners think and do and choose to ask people to do for them, and there are probably more good designers and architects than there are really good commissioners. So the challenge is finding those people with that vision to understand that maybe in a city the best way to push that city, a new evolving city, or the mayor of a new city in Middle East or Asia or something might not be to build a fandabulous new art gallery, but might be to make the best hospitals. And I would love to work on a hospital project, because some of the worst environments I come into contact with are health environments. And actually the culture ones, they're all fine, you know, the obvious museums and libraries, but it's the unobvious ones. And I think the lateralness of commissioning is always the challenge for myself as a designer, to find that. And you can initiate projects, and I believe in trying to initiate them if no one's asking for a certain kind of thing to happen. You're only as good as your commissioner.
And where do you see yourself in terms of a sort of canon or a trajectory? It's what you were talking about just then sounds like, you know, there's a tradition of industrial design and looking for this great commissioner and this idea of function. Is that what really drives you as a designer?
I mean, it sounds maybe soppy and idealistic, but I'm within our work, we're trying to make places be better, make things be better. That's what really is motivating. I don't feel that my job is to stamp my studio's mark on the world somehow. It's to try to, as best we can, to do projects that have meaning and work well. And it's easier to do that if you're just doing something for yourself that's going to go in a gallery. But if you're doing something that's out there in sitting on the street with the rain and someone dropping a kebab in front and all of these, it's gritty, and there are many permissions needed, many people who need to come along to make that happen. So there's a lot that explains why a lot of new zones and areas and projects that we experience aren't that special. Or when I say special, it doesn't mean something has to be just kind of wah at you, but just where there's a thought carried through and a care, because there's a lot that conspires against things being having more qualities about them. And so it means your team have to be very determined. And I was never good at any sports other than long distance endurance things. I can kind of hang in there, and that I think that built environment projects, you need quite a lot of determination. And so we sort of try to keep that sense of a long-term pace.
And who are these patrons and mentors and commissioners that you've had along the way? I mean, I know that you started at one point working for Conran and built a gazebo in his garden. Is there any one person that's really, you know, inspired you or championed you?
Well, Terence Conran became a friend, and I mean, it's quite an old-fashioned word, but the mentor. He, at the time when I was studying, buildings were theoretical. The designing buildings which had any level of ambition in them, it was the theoretical thing, and there was almost resignation that, of course, things were never going to be built. And so I was trying to push things to happen, and there was a scale of building that was just about within grasp, which was this scale, pavilion scale. And back, the first one I did was 21 years ago, and back then no one was doing pavilions or gazebos or structures, the Serpentine, or there was a scale that wasn't happening, and you needed all the help you could get to find sponsorship and make things like that happen. And when I was at the Royal College of Art, I had the fortune to meet Terence Conran in a corridor at the college, and I grabbed that moment really, because I was aware that he was a person who understood both the urge to try to pursue excellence in how you conceived of a project, but also someone who was rooted in the reality of bringing projects to people, whether that's within habitats or his bigger projects where he's built restaurants and hotels and things in various places around the world. But he understood, he had his foot in both aspects, and it felt at that time back then the Royal College of Art was just rooted in the ideas bit, and I was interested in how do you bring that into reality, because it seemed a shame to have ideas and them not become reality. So bumping into him, and he offered that I could come and speak to him for 5 minutes and where he was based in Docklands, and I went to see him, and he was so generous. He gave me 3 hours and showed me everything they were doing, and at the end invited me that if at the college, as there was no space in this art college that's in one of the most high-value real estate locations in London, he offered that I could stay live at his house for 4 months to build this building project, and his house in Berkshire. And it was such a generous thing to let a student who you'd only met a week earlier do this. And so there was that sense of someone who was their good angel, willing the best for you. And I'm very interested in any scale. There's the cost of building projects is so high. No one does them just to feel good or just to be a good person. Projects have to make economic sense. So all of our projects, we are looking at how to define the value that they bring, and having to always push for the essence of an idea at the most cost-effective way to deliver that in order to for it to exist. So we're working with property developers in Hong Kong and China and in Singapore and in as well as in the UK. And so our work on all of those things is needing to understand the business motivator that brings a project into being and seeing how it can... I don't feel that it's in opposition, a business objective, with specialness. I mean, more and more people are looking for... So-called business is more sophisticated than ever. And I think the public recognise when something is a cynical, rolled-out repetition of something that exists everywhere else in the world, and spotting when there is a soulfulness in the energies behind the delivery of a project. And I believe that you know what, you can't fool people. They're genuine. They want something that's serious. I don't believe that in patronizing people. I think you can go for what excites you is most likely to excite others. And if you somehow temper it in some sense that because you think others won't understand, I think that's when you lose everything.
And what about your inspirations when you have these incredible ergonomic forms? There's something of an artist in you, and your stairways look like landscapes, for instance. Where do you draw these inspirations from?
I try to see each project as its own thing and try to understand the context of a particular site for a building and then try to grow the solution from the specific mix of aspects affecting that site, and then see if there's something that sort of coheres and can grow into an idea for that project. I find that in the studio, I mean, I don't run in the morning with streaking from a bath with the idea. It tends to be through our dialogue, and I think I get most excited by the discussions with a commissioner, with a property developer, with my team. That my job is, I'm slightly like it's like table tennis in a way. It feels like you're batting backwards and forwards ideas, testing and exploring ideas by knocking them around. And that's pace when it's going best is when it's like a table tennis. You know that noise, the very hypnotic noise of a table tennis ball is when a good discussion, and it needn't even be with a designer, with somebody who's working, you're working together to explore the possibilities within a specific project. And so I've learned in a way to draw through dialogue somehow as much as drawing with pens and paper and equipment.
And finally, we love the bus at Monocle, and congratulations on the new London bus. I wondered, as we're working on our quality of life issue, whether you could give us any insights into what your opinion is on, whether you can design around crime or designing for a civic purpose, how your designs affect a quality of life, and the bus is a very good example.
We felt such a responsibility when asked to do the bus. We were aware that no design team had been allowed or commissioned for 50 years to work on that, and yet London's famous for its London buses, and yet the environment had degraded and over time to something that's kind of specified from catalogues virtually. And so I have no claim of trying to make people feel in a certain way, but I think what you can do is do the quality of environment that you would want for yourself. And whatever effect that has, then I'll let that have that. But the goal is to make something that is the best we can possibly make it. And then how people respond, that's over to them. And I think that I sort of trust making things better rather than defining the outcome as being a social outcome. I think we're well aware that doing certain things might have certain social, societal outcomes. But I think it's dangerous when you start by saying the job is to make people feel good about themselves. Then I think you're into very dodgy territory as to what does design do if that's your goal. Whereas if it's just to make the best possible way to transport people around London, that's a goal. And if being in the best possible way of transporting someone, even better than a sports car or something, better views because you're over London. If the outcome is people feel good, good. But the goal is just to make it work well for the passenger. And I leave it over to them, the rest.
That was Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, with British designer Thomas Heatherwick at the V&A in London. Time for a quick break, but stay tuned. We're off to Lord's Cricket Ground after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly programme on the best in design, architecture, graphics and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology and driving.
Every Saturday at midday in London, join our editors on Monocle 24 for The Review. We take you on a tour of three bookshops in three cities to hear what's flying off the shelves. We listen to some top tracks with a music aficionado from a different region. And we review a stack of our favourite new magazines each week too. That's The Review, the perfect way to start your weekend, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Section D. The world's property market is on the rocks, and investors everywhere are turning to increasingly unconventional ways to make a return. One area experiencing something of a mini-boom is mid-century furniture. No longer just reserved for a handful of Jacobson-obsessed anoraks, modernist furniture is an increasingly legitimate financial asset. Though most dealers are quick to impart the golden rule still remains, that you must buy what you like. Monocle's Adrian Craddock was at last Sunday's Modern Furniture Show at Lord's in North London to get tips on how to shop for top-end mid-century wares.
This is a sideboard by Martin Visser, Dutch designer who died in 2009. It's the KW08 sideboard in Wenge wood with painted white cupboards.
That's Jonathan Stevenson of Rocket Gallery in London's East End. He's one of the many traders at the Mid-Century Show, an event dedicated to celebrating modernist design from the 50s and 60s. Like most of the 40-odd vendors at the show, Jonathan is reporting a spike in interest and sales for his high-end wares.
Broadly speaking, we have two markets. We have the international market and we have London. And our clients basically come either from very close proximity to our gallery, or we are exporting the furniture to America, Germany. We're increasingly selling to Japan. Yeah, I'd say there's no particular one market. It's just overall around the world there's an increase in interest.
The purchase of mid-century furniture used to be reserved to a select group of diehards. Now its appeal has become increasingly mainstream, as David Tatham from Modern Design explains.
At one stage, there was more of a train spotter element to it. Very few people really bought it. And I mean, a lot of people wouldn't even consider buying something secondhand unless it was an antique. But now that attitude is changing rapidly. I mean, more people now will consider buying something that's not just secondhand, but that's a mid-century piece for the fact that it's even almost like they would buy an antique. You know, they're buying it because they can tell that it's got a history and they know it's good quality. You know, I guess people who are reasonably wealthy are looking at mid-century pieces as an alternative to what they'd buy new, because price-wise, it's quite similar to good quality new furniture.
But for all the talk of history and craftsmanship, is mid-century furniture a legitimate financial investment that could provide substantial returns? I asked Mark Page from C20C.
Yes, but you've got to be careful. You know, there's a lot of it was mass-produced, and you've got to be rather selective, and you've got to also check whether any of it's being reproduced, because if you buy anything that's being reproduced at the moment, then obviously there's going to be lots of them around in better condition than the originals. I tend to go for stuff that isn't named. So something that is quirky, something that you look at and you think, God, I won't see that again. But we don't know who it's by. It's definitely 1950s, 1960s. I think that's the way forward, is more anonymous but good quality items.
Mark deals in one of the more interesting niche markets of mid-century furniture. Rather than leaning on the traditions of Swedish and Danish designs, He's a champion of countries that are less known for their modernist output.
If you buy any of the lifestyle magazines, you know, the whether it's Living, etc., or World of Interiors, etc., they always have an Eames chair in, a Jacobson, and the problem is, you know, that's stifling the market. Everyone thinks that this is all we're restricted to. People should go out there and look at something purely on the aesthetic values, not because it's a name. And look at it and say, right, do I like that? Could I live with that? Is it comfortable? Is it fit for purpose? And don't just buy purely because some article mentions a name.
Do you think that that's kind of homogenised the market in a way?
Very much so, yeah, very much so. Increasingly, good quality stuff is starting to emerge from France and Italy. And some of it's coming from Germany as well, actually. A lot of the Danish and the Americans was based on architecture. Whereas a lot of the French stuff wasn't linked to architecture in any way. And it tends to be, as I say, a lot more flamboyant than, say, the straight lines and the simplicity of, say, Scandinavian furniture and American furniture.
And how long have you been trading mid-century furniture?
I've been trading 6 years.
And has the market changed at all during that time?
At the moment, the middle market is dead. In what I'm selling, it's the top end. And the only reason for that, I think, is that the very affluent, they can't invest in property. There's, you know, you can't make any money out of property anymore. You're not going to get any return from the banks. So they're investing into top-end quality furniture, predominantly French and Italian, and they're living with it, they're enjoying it, but of course it's still an investment, so they could sell it in 4 or 5 years' time.
The word investment doesn't sit well with all dealers. To many, the golden rule is still buy what you like.
I don't talk about them in terms of investment like a lot of people would, because I think that's crazy. Your investment is the fact that you're going to use it and keep it for a long time. I think more it's like if you buy something that's quite special and you buy it because you really love it, you keep it for a long time. That to me is a very sound investment. But it does have a side effect that if you do want to get rid of it, you will get your money back, you know, which is fantastic. So it's a win-win situation, really.
For some customers, the motivation to buy historical furniture can sometimes be deeply personal. When I saw Helen Jeans, she was carrying an elegant Urquhart coffee table back to her car.
I've just bought a small table. It's in Elm, mm-hmm. And it's made by Urquharts.
And why did you decide to buy that over, say, a modern piece of furniture?
My grandfather worked for Urquhart's, and he died quite a few years ago. And he worked in the Urquhart factory in High Wycombe, where I was born, from the age of 15 to 65 when he retired. He used to put the pieces of plain uncut wood into the machine and cut them.
Do you think he would be surprised that, you know, some of the furniture that he may have helped produce has got such his kind of cult following now?
He would be very surprised. He would appreciate the fact we now appreciate that quality and and the care that was taken.
For those without a family connection to the industry, the increased push to buy has been fueled partly by popular media. Yeah. The success of the American drama Mad Men, set in the chic offices of a New York advertising agency, has renewed an interest for mid-century aesthetic. Surprisingly though, some dealers put it down to the strengths of Scandinavia's TV exports. David Tatham explains.
We occasionally get the odd email saying we're doing an office and we want the Mad Men look. Yeah. So we do occasionally get that. But it's just, I would say, for us, the media-wise, this year and last year, the Danish dramas have been very good, like The Killing, Borgen, and the most recent one, The Bridge. Because in Scandinavia, they bought domestic furniture, and they still do. They still buy. They spend more money than we do on furniture. So, you know, a domestic home will have quite nice things in. And that's reflected in those programmes. And I think that that's kind of the stylish way they've been shot. It's been better for us than Mad Men.
For organiser Lucy Ryder Richardson, it's the other way around.
I think we affected Mad Men, to be honest. I can't say that the Americans weren't there first. They were, with their love of mid-century. They produced it in such a big way in the 50s and 60s. But Mad Men, the television programme, came about because there was such a return to this kind of furniture and this kind of lifestyle.
But Lucy's business partner, Petra Curtis, says the timeless designs and sturdy builds on offer at the mid-century show means their business is almost immune to fluctuating trends and fashions. In the 10 years since the show began, they've experienced no effect from the 2008 recession or the Eurozone currency crisis.
You know, each fair, we think, surely now there must be signs of the effect. But touch wood, you know, we have been very lucky that thousands of people still come to our shows and people are buying mid-century furniture because it is still value for money. If you want a good quality sideboard and you're prepared to spend £400 or £500, then the quality that you will get from a mid-century sideboard will last you for another 20, 30 years, if not longer. Whereas if you buy a new sideboard, potentially it could be in the skip in 2 years' time.
So is mid-century furniture the new modern art? And are we likely to soon see wealthy collectors create private museums of beautifully designed appointments? Jonathan Stevenson is sceptical.
Furniture's never going to sort of quite do the same thing as art because furniture is first and foremost, it's practical, it's functional, people buy it in order to use. Our clients who cross over between art and furniture and design, for them it's much easier to buy furniture because they can justify it as something that, you know, if they put some money into, they're going to use it, so they're going to get value out like that. While, of course, art is a much more difficult purchase because you're putting it on your wall and it doesn't have a function as such.
That was Monocle's Adrian Craddock reporting at the Modern Furniture Show at Lord's Cricket Ground in London last week. Furniture and product design fairs are to a penny these days. It would be feasible, though perhaps not much fun, to spend the entire year hopping from one to another. Clerkenwell Design Week in London is now in its third year, and along with a growing number of international designers and businesses, it's the neighbourhood itself that takes centre stage. Purposefully contrasting the dull environment of an exhibition hall, designers display their best wares in the streets, shops and even churches of this historic neighbourhood. David Pleasant headed over to Clerkenwell to see what it's all about.
Design professionals have a natural propensity to collaborate and form communities. In London, one area in particular has become a definitive design centre for the city. The Clerkenwell neighbourhood has a long tradition of craft and trade. From map makers to jewellers and clockmakers, the sound of metal being tinkered and printing presses rolling used to fill the air, and there are still plenty of these firms left. Today, contemporary design, from international furniture showrooms to tiny design studios to scores of architecture practices, define the area. For the last 3 years, the area's streets and squares have hosted the annual Clerkenwell Design Week. This year, over 40 venues, including church crypts, historic warehouses, and even a former subterranean jail, became the setting for diverse furniture and product designers to show off their wares. With hundreds of exhibitors, major international firms and sponsors, and thousands of visitors, the festival has cemented the area's position as London's design hub.
My name's Stephen Block, and I'm the event manager for Clerkenwell Design Week. It's the third year and we've grown every year a little bit more. So we've grown vertically and horizontally. Just naturally, really. It's something that we always wanted to do as long as the event was needed and wanted and had a purpose. It's a very easy place to fall in love with because it's quite village-like in the middle of London and it's a little bit of a gem. So I think that's certainly attractive to those people, especially the architects. But also the area has a history of craftsmanship and it's grown from watchmakers and map makers and slowly led through to the current adoptees of the area, if you mm-hmm. like. Yeah.
There's a second building that's been attached more recently, in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So the room that we're in now would have originally been a storeroom for the sheets of lead and glass, so a very different kind of environment to what we're looking at today. But it's still retained that feel. You kind of understand it, looking at it architecturally, how it was used and what would have gone on in here. And the same for the offices that are Victorian as well. We have a retail zone in there at the moment where we have design retailers selling their wares, but that used to be an office. It's very much like something from a detective novel. And it's actually been used for the Batman movie and has doubled for things like Gotham City police station. So
It's
very evocative of very noir-esque, I would say. It's very different from other exhibitions in that we don't have shell schemes, we don't have big glitzy stands. It's really just about the pieces. And I think the rawness of the space really highlights them. Obviously there are very colourful and attractive glossy pieces here and you can see that very clearly here.
Yeah. They kind of speak for themselves.
They do.
And the building somehow speaks for the area in Clerkenwell. And
Yeah, it's very East London, it's very industrial, and it's very unique. It's amazing to come back here every year. It's a real honour, actually.
Can you kind of paint a picture of the design world at the moment?
Well, I think from what we've seen a kind of an ebb and flow with different businesses. So we started out in the first year with some that have unfortunately had to move out of Clerkenwell on the showroom side, and that's possibly an effect of the recession and orders. But more recently, and certainly this year, we've heard from a lot of the furniture manufacturers and designers that there has been a lot more interest in the early part of this year, and there is more excitement and people want to get involved with these things. They kind of feel it's a necessity to do it, despite the hard work and the costs involved. They really want to do that, and they want to be seen somewhere that is the best launch pad for their product.
The fair attracts local residents as well as design professionals and clients. With its narrow streets and charming squares and courtyards, Clerkenwell can feel like a small town. Down a narrow alley, another intriguing venue opens its doors. Deep under the street, the 17th century House of Detention plays host to more than 30 design companies and their products.
My name is Jason Pawlowski, and our design collective is called Quartet. It's a great neighbourhood to work in. We've got, obviously, lots of exciting companies around us, and, you know, on the streets, of course, there's lots of cyclists and associated people around there. We've got Look Mum and Hands down the road. We've got other component people around, you know, people up the road making similar things. So it's very exciting in that respect, because we feel we're in a community, not only a design community, but also a cycling community as well.
What is this that we have in front of us?
It's called Branchline, and it's interesting because we picked the name because it's got branches, and the fact that it's made out of this really exquisite bamboo, three-block pipe, bamboo, makes it extremely modern, and at the same time hints at modern furniture or contemporary modern furniture. The beauty of and the reason why we call it furniture for bikes and not bike racks is because actually it does look like a piece of furniture.
Definitely.
Yeah. It solves the purpose of obviously displaying, organizing your bike at home, but even when the bike is not there, it's got a presence that is indisputable, unique. And people fall in love with it, clearly. Whether it's these exquisite details in leather or nickel, you know, metal fittings, or maybe even just a simple, you know, detail of a quick release from a bike to adjust the arms to accept any geometry of the bike frames. I think once you decide that your bike has to leave at home, there's no doubt you want to make it look like the coolest chair or coffee table that you actually, you know, deserve or you wish to deserve. So in essence, yes, it is modern contemporary furniture was our inspiration, yes.
Clerkenwell Design Week has managed to provide a platform for the area's design community to show off the fruits of their creativity, and is increasingly a commercial success. It has also increased the collaboration between the different professions and engaged the urban landscape. The area's heritage has become the perfect setting for some of the very best in contemporary design. The event is a trade fair with a difference, with a unique local identity that manages to celebrate the neighbourhood as well as its designers.
That was Monocle's David Pleasant reporting there at Clerkenwell Design Week in London. Time now to leave London behind and head all the way to Auckland. One of the latest additions to Auckland's fashion industry is the New Zealand Fashion Museum. Its most recent exhibition explored how the colour black became such a strong part of the Kiwi identity. This show attracted over 10,000 visitors and merited the publication of Black, the History of Black in Fashion, Society and Culture in New Zealand. Federico Monsalve sat down with the surprisingly colourful Doris DuPont, the book's author and founder of the museum, to discuss her favourite things.
I was thinking about it when you asked me which are my favourite things, and it occurred to me that many of them have to do with clothing, with what one wears. So, you know, shoes and dresses, and indeed a dress that belonged to my mother. She got it in 1968, and I personally have never been a big collector of or a hoarder, really. So since I've been working on the Fashion Museum, I'm perhaps more attuned to things that are a little older, and that have some stories in them. When my mother moved out of her home and into a retirement home, there were a lot of things in her house, and this was one of them. It's a black, and it's lovely because it's from 68, and so it's in a crepe. It's a very good quality dress, but of course the crepe in 68 was polyester. There was nothing natural in the fabrics and fibres in the 60s. They were very proud of the synthetics and the wonderful qualities of synthetic fabrics. So it's just a very, very simple shift. It's got a very heavily embroidered sort of lace, a deep hem on it. My mother got it indeed for a function in Holland. My dressmaking scissors, I've had them since 1973. They're unusual for here in that most of the dressmaking scissors that were used in New Zealand were very heavy forged steel scissors. So they're quite sort of chunky and heavy. And these are Germans. They're from Solinger. They're very lightweight, very slender scissors, so they're really light in the hand and really easy to use. And as a dressmaking scissor, they've got a very flat base so that they can travel along a flat surface and just lift the top blade and cut into the fabric. Very fine points, so you can do cornering and things like that. And they are lovely and light. And if anybody dare touches them and use them for anything else, it's under pain of death that you use them to cut anything other than fabric. So I have here a beautiful pot that was made by some New Zealand potters, Chuck Joseph and Louise Rye from Edge City Studios. And I love it because it reminds me of Dutch Delft blue. So it's, the blue and white decoration on it. And it's got that sort of white glaze that you get from the iron glazes that they use in porcelain glazing. Totally references my Dutch heritage, but it's also absolutely New Zealand because the decoration on it is of the hills around Auckland. So there's a Māori pass site, One Tree Hill with the tree still on it is on there.
Oh, yeah.
And Rangitoto. And the Southern Cross in the stars around the top band, and the decorative motifs are Polynesian. So you've got the sort of sharp spikes, a Polynesian tatau and fish around the bottom, fish swimming around the bottom, the sea around the bottom.
Is this something that probably we could look at it and say, yeah, it's definitely something that would have influenced the way you made clothing as well?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, one of the other pieces I've got here is a piece from a collect that I did with a New Zealand artist, John Pule. And this is a Perspex headpiece that was made for that collection. The collection was called Let's Gather Here. And it talked really about New Zealand and the cultures that have come to New Zealand. It's inspired by Victorian bonnets. And in fact, Victorian bonnets were made in the Pacific out of tortoiseshell.
Oh, right.
Yes, yeah, so they, here they, in the Pacific Islands, they sort of imitated them into a sort of a tortoiseshell version. So this is inspired by that, so it's got that shape. But it also, worn the other way, it's like a Polynesian crown, often the headdresses, the performing headdresses and ceremonial headdresses are quite tall, and it's screen printed with hibiscus and feathers, imagery from the John Pule print that we used in the in the collection. Yeah. So it's a very cross-cultural representation. This is Karl Fritsch, German jeweler. This ring looks like it's made out of plasticine, which is what I love about it.
Yeah.
So he makes these rings that look like toys. So he's playing, with the idea of jewellery, what it's about, and he's making it playful, at the same time having the most remarkable skills, because as you can see, this ring is, sort of pinched in a way, band, so it's a bit sort of lumpy and uneven. And then it's got a bauble, like a bobble on top, which has got diamonds set into it. They look like they've just been pushed into this plasticine.
It's nice and heavy
as
well.
It's very, very heavy.
Very tactile.
It's a very tactile ring. And I love that sort of trickery of it. It looks sort of cheap and fun, and yet it's incredibly crafted. A simple solution is often very complex to achieve, is probably my point. I can actually remember shoes from earlier than I can remember dresses. I can remember my mother having a pair of green snakeskin sandals, and I would have been about three when she had those, but I can remember them very, very vividly. I could probably draw them for you.
This ones are fantastic.
They're fantastic, aren't they?
They're architectural almost.
They are, and they're Japanese, you know, with the shoes with the wooden supports at the front and the back. And these are actually German. They're made by Trippin, so they use rubber. And they use natural dyed leathers and unfinished edges. And so these are, you know, very fashionable because everyone's wearing platforms, so they're platforms. They're also very up to date in that they're very green. You know, they're using sort of natural materials and sort of low impact materials. You know, of making a very small footprint on the earth. But I think one of the things that people sometimes forget when they're making that small footprint is that it should also be a very beautiful footprint.
That was Federico Monsalve with Doris DuPont in Auckland. Time for a short break, but stay tuned. We're off to Stockholm after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Join us at midday London time every weekday for The Briefing, Monocle 24's fast-paced hour-long roundup of global breaking news stories, in-studio analysis, and a first look at the North American front pages. And for those waking up on the East Coast, it's the perfect way to get a Monocle take on the stories you need to know at the start of each day. The Briefing, live at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York and 6 a.m. in Chicago.
Welcome back to Section D. Electrolux is one of Sweden's most successful historic household names. Founded in 1919, it has made its way into almost every home in the world with its Hoovers and appliances, large and small. At the Salone del Mobile in Milan recently, Electrolux launched a new line called Inspiration. It's a move into the luxury sector for the brand, and I sat down with Thomas Johansson, the design director behind the range, to hear more about it.
My name is Thomas Johansson, and I am the head of design for Electrolux Major Appliances Europe. So I work with all the kitchen products here in Europe.
And at Eurocucina in Milan recently, you launched a new range that's sort of a new direction for Electrolux. Maybe you could tell me a bit about that.
The range is called Inspiration. It was launched, as you said, at Eurocucina. It's a complete range of built-in products, freestanding products, over 200 separate products. It's pushing up like Electrolux into the premium segment, also picking up on our professional heritage, so it's a fantastic range.
Why do you think now is the time to sort of explore that territory and push into that market?
It's an important one to go up into premium because there's a lot of pressure from below. And a lot of competition, lower competition from the Far East, are coming in from the bottom of the market. And also interesting picking up the professional heritage or the professional connection, because that's an important part of Electrolux business, and there's so much knowledge and experience there, so put it into also the normal customer products.
And so the idea is that you have this wealth of experienced people who are using Electrolux products, and you're now tapping into them to see how you can develop these products better. Is that right?
Now, like 50% of all the Michelin restaurants in Europe are working on Electrolux products. So again, pick into that, both like knowledge-wise about reliability, about their how they work with pre-programmed steam probes. There's a lot of technology in there, and again, take this technology and don't overcomplicate it, but take out the things like normal users could find usable or helpful.
And Electrolux as a brand, I think probably everybody in the world has heard of it, knows of it. But I mean, to me, it means vacuum cleaners and kitchen appliances. What is it that separates Electrolux from its competitors? What does it have a sort of core brand philosophy, do you think?
We have our Scandinavian heritage, which is about putting the human being in the centre. So looking a lot at our end consumers. So we work a lot with consumer insights, so going into people's homes and looking at trying to find like real needs. So we talk about a lot about relevance in our innovation. So not just making innovation for the sake of making something new, but there has to be relevance and meaning to what we do.
That's actually quite interesting, talking about it in a Scandinavian design context for creating things that people need and live with. And when people think of Scandinavian design, they're probably more likely to think of furniture and tableware and things that they live with in day-to-day life. But actually, all the things that you make at Electrolux are things that people live with on a day-to-day basis as well. Is your idea to constantly push at making these better?
Now, if there is going to be meaning in what we do, I think products have to be better, because otherwise we're just making more products for the just sake of it. So relevance, meaning, and also about making like the experience of using products. Our products are a lot about everyday usage, and also about making everyday lives much easier to live, or a modern life. Like, a lot of people are quite stressed, and time is valuable. So make the experience of working with a vacuum cleaner, fridge, an oven, make it into like a positive, good experience. I think that's like a bit at the heart of what we're trying to do.
We were chatting before, and you've worked at Electrolux for many years. I think it's quite easy that the products that Electrolux produces are sort of seen as culprits in sort of a world where we're all more conscious of sustainability and particularly how we dispose of these things. Has that sort of changed the way that Electrolux works as a company, having to incorporate sustainability into your design ethos?
Sustainability is important for us, and especially as a Scandinavian company, so this is again in our blood. We did a lot of products within the vacuum in the floor care business. We did the Ultra Sinister Green, which was the first vacuum cleaner where we took down the wattage to half, took away I think it was it over 50, probably 60% reused plastics. This is also within the kitchen appliances. So looking constantly at water consumption, energy consumption, we got to take these. There's a lot of responsibility, and Electrolux puts out, 40 million products a year? There's a lot of responsibility in that. So again, not just making products, so making products that are better for the environment. So looking a lot at water consumption and energy consumption.
Making products that work more efficiently, presumably, as well, and sort of use less energy in the process.
I think it's not just about the energy is the big thing, because that is the big cost. But then also looking at materials, and also looking at the ethics of us as a company. So how are our factories, what type of energy are they using? This is a big focus now.
Electrolux is one of Sweden's biggest companies. I mean, over the last however many years, you've bought so many other companies in regional markets. When you incorporate other companies, do you sort of systematically try and sort of get them to embrace the Electrolux way of managing and working? Or I mean, how do you go about sort of creating a singular way of working when you have so many different regional outposts at the same time?
But we work a lot with a system we call One Electrolux, and that is about everything from leadership to values. There's a foundation to things, so there's a way of an Electrolux way of one doing business, how we are towards each other, how we drive product development. So getting if you do, as Electrolux has in the history of growing through acquisitions, and the important thing is how to still make it bond that all those acquisitions together and then work as one company. So this is also something we drive quite hard.
And is it quite fluid between the companies? And if I worked in the headquarters in Stockholm
And then I went to visit one of the factories in Cairo. Would I be able to tell that I was in an Electrolux factory, do you think?
You would know that. This is so we talk a lot about culture. It's also like a culture within the company. So they're like to like build and develop an Electrolux culture. And part of that is that you should recognize yourself. That, like, there's a way of, there's an Electrolux way of having a factory.
And how many people work for Electrolux now?
There are 58,000 people today, so it's a big company. Growing and the very tough growth strategy also, so we're going to grow more.
That was me with Thomas Johansson, the design director at Electrolux in Stockholm recently. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we'll be hopping over to Chicago to visit the Neocon Furniture Trade Show. We'll then head to Berlin for the DMY Design Fair, and we'll sit down with a new crop of graduates from the Antwerp Fashion Academy. So be sure to tune in for all that and much more. Today's show was produced by Gillian DeBias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. And playing you out, here's a track from Grimes. This is Oblivion. Goodbye.